Well, welcome everybody. I hope you're ready to get wet tonight and go down the river. And, you know, I've got a little something for everybody tonight. We're going to be talking about some of the presidents only up until 1900, so it'll be fairly tame. We're going to talk about the Transcontinental Railroad, the Underground Railroad, just a wide variety of topics. So hopefully, what we'll end up with is a sense of gratitude for being Americans, because America, in some sense, is like a growing pyramid. And where we are at the top right now took sacrifices and discoveries and explorations of a wide variety of people. And John Wesley Powell's story typifies one of those. Now, let's start in 1869. And 1869 was a pretty big year in American history because the Transcontinental Railroad was finished on May 10th. Powell started his journey on May 24th of the same year. And one of the first deliveries ever done by the railroad was to bring his boats to the Green River and literally just drop them off there. They didn't charge him anything. It was one of the very first deliveries. Also, Ulysses S. Grant was the president of the United States. The Civil War had ended about 4 years earlier. Obviously, he was the general of the North and became president. It was the beginning of the Second Industrial Revolution. And everything was starting to move west, sort of this whole idea of manifest destiny. There was, however, one conspicuous area of the country that was completely unexplored, and that was sort of the diamond shape. It was known as the Great Unknown, and to everybody's understanding, nobody had actually traversed the Colorado River in its entirety. This was a painting from the time, and it's the Spirit of the Frontier. The large figure is Columbia, and Columbia was the name given sort of to America and the Americans. It's like a new Latin toponym. And topo is name, or topo is place, and nim is name. And so based on Christopher Columbus, the sort of like twist was to call Americans Columbia. And the 13 original states were Columbia. So then, so the Columbia River, Columbia University, things like that are actually derived from it. She's dressed in a Roman toga to sort of represent the principles of a republic. She's got a wires in her hand to represent technology.
She's drinking the wires.
And as we go west, that would be the telegraph, and then the train would have been the technology of the time. That was big tech. There's the light in the east, and the west was considered to be dark, and this manifest destiny would take us and civilize it and bring law and order to it. And you'll notice that the Indians are looking back in fear, as they well should have. The bison are running for their lives. As we mentioned before, there were about 50 million of them when the Europeans came, and they were hunted down to under 30, which were herded into Yellowstone, and now there's about 5,000 remaining of the original genome. So this was a sort of like a picture of the times. And although manifest destiny wasn't a doctrine of the United States, it was more of an attitude, the Homestead Act was, in 1962 that was presented. And
1860.
Thanks. Yeah, you're gonna have to tell me that several times. youngish as I am. And that people were, you could get 160 acres of land. You just had to go out there, live there for 5 years, and improve the land a little bit. So it was sort of a free-for-all in many respects. This is the specific territory. The box on the left is enlarged on the right. And that is the Colorado River. And the river is about, I'd say 1,450 miles long, stretches from the Rocky Mountains all the way down, and used to drop into Baja California's Sea of Cortez, but it no longer does. The water is all taken before it actually gets there. Now, Powell is often referred to as the American Odysseus, and as you know from the Odyssey that, as they travel through many, many dangers that are unknown, and in this, on the right-hand side, there's the sirens, and, he has to, plug his ears with wax and have himself bound to the mast so that he's not driven to do exceptionally unreasonable things. And when, there are these great expeditions where there are tremendous challenges, our natures are sort of heated up. And, when you're sitting back in an auditorium and looking at it, you say, oh, well, this is easy and that's easy. But when they're on the spot, it's really, really, really difficult. And the challenge is, can you sort of keep it together? Can you keep your balance? Can you keep your focus? And that's what Powell tried to do on this expedition as he went out with just four boats that were 21 feet long into a canyon that he had no map of. He did not know what was coming, if there were waterfalls. They just sort of went. It was one of those great expeditions where you just fly into it. It was put on a postage stamp after the fact. The postage stamp says a lot. First of all, Powell only had one arm. One of his arms was blown off in the Civil War, in the Battle of Shiloh. And the boats that they chose were just very, very small, and they were really made to sort of go into ocean and choppy waters, but not rapids. So they didn't, and none of the crew had experience. And was Mr. Toad's wild ride all the way.
Which year was the stamp?
Which year was a stamp? Oh, good question. I'm not a numismatist, so I can't really say. I'd have to look that one up. Here's a close-up of the area. How many have been to the Grand Canyon? Okay, so a few haven't. Has anybody actually floated down? Wonderful. Oh, delightful. Okay, that's remarkable. Well, it starts up in the Rocky Mountains and flows on down, but there's a tremendous number of tributaries into the Colorado. The Colorado serves as a source of water for about 50 million people. Today there are about 12 dams on it, but when Powell went through it, it was the first time that any European had been through the whole thing. There were individuals who tried it. The first person tried it on a log, literally, and the second known party.
What happened?
What would you expect? I didn't drown. He just kind of tumbled around. The log got away from him, and then he walked back.
Who was
it? I don't know. The second party made a boat out of bison skin.
Oh.
And the rapids, are fairly daunting. I cobbled together a movie. It's about a 25-minute movie that I'll show you that will highlight the first-person journey of Powell. Clay Jenkinson, who's a historian from Washington, portrays Powell, and then I've got a whole bunch of historical photographs and a number of things that I think will be interesting to you. All right, this is Powellite, and it's the best representation of John Wesley Powell that I could find. Because he was a very, very unusual character. This was discovered in a mine in 1890, and the guy who discovered it just spontaneously named it after him. And That's a crystal. But what's interesting about it, if you shine ultraviolet light on this crystal, it starts to glow different colors, predominantly gold. And so what I thought, you know, we could do is maybe shine an ultraviolet light on Pal's character and try to like draw out the lines of force that led him to undertake this remarkable journey. The key to it all, we think, is his stance on anti-slavery. He was born in 1834 in Ohio, and his father was a Methodist preacher. The family was definitely against slavery of any kind, against alcohol, and they would preach and promote that. However, many of the inhabitants in Ohio loved to drink and loved slavery. So this caused a schism, and then when John Wesley Powell, he was known as Wes, went to school, they would throw rocks at him, beat him up, and so forth. And so his parents decided, well, why don't we just keep you home, and you can just learn on your own. He knew how to read. But there was a local character, and he was a sort of a free spirit. Big George Hookham was his name. He weighed over 300 pounds. And people said his heart and his mind was equally large. He ran a school for adults that couldn't read or do a lot of things. He was a naturalist. He had a little museum in his house. He wrote books. Spent a lot of his time sort of outdoors exploring. And when he found that Wes was without a school, he took him under his wing and brought him in and started to read him various things that were, you know, something he wouldn't have been exposed to in a regular school. And, you know, Wes kind of caught the spirit of it, that you're not only reading books, but you're reading the hills, you're reading nature, and ultimately you're reading yourself, and that all those are connected in various ways. So they worked together extremely well, and you know, Big George would introduce him to his friends, and they were also interested in geology and all of these things. But one day he took them farther out than they normally go, and Wes was starting to think, you know, I wonder why we're going this far out. And he took him up into a cave where there were three black men who were on the Underground Railroad. These were men who escaped from where they were slaves, and they would like travel mostly by night, and there would be outposts along the way, people who would help them, people who would give them food and shelter for a period of time. And he introduced them and he explained to them, you know, it's not enough just to believe something, you have to do something about it. And in Big George was a helper on the Underground Railroad. And so Wes got to know these people and understand their plight. And sort of, it really struck a chord with him about it, the equality of not just all people, but all of nature. So this homeschooling really took off and generated the lines of force. So, you know, the big hero of this story tonight is Big George, because he's the one that sowed all the seeds that grew into these sort of like crystals that streamed out from Powline. Later, people kind of caught on to Big George and what he was doing. They beat him up. They burned his house down. He kept going, but clearly he was an injured individual. Powell and the family, they, you know, moved to another location after a period of time. John Wesley would often, as a teenager, go out and explore rivers on his own. He was very interested in things like mollusks and freshwater species. He taught himself geometry. He'd always be reading. But he'd write in his books that he was always searching for himself, trying to discover himself. And the natural scientists. So Big George had sort of like taught him how to find fossils and how to, you know, how to classify various things in nature. So he was a learner. You know, his candle was lit very prominently. a natural explorer. Now, about a mile from where the family lived, a group of Indians, Winnebago Indians, who previously had lived on the land, but the U.S. government bought it and sold it off to settlers. But this was their sort of native hunting ground. And so they settled in for a season about a mile from where the Powells live. And Wes, just with a very open mind, went over and sort of like hung out with them and learned from them and really started to like them. He learned their ways. He sort of gained an understanding. Later in his life, he would become an ethnologist. But clearly, the idea of having an understanding of the American Indians as people rather than adversaries is very important. The Civil War came along, and he couldn't wait to sign up quick enough. He felt, you know, the Civil War was fought mainly in relation to slavery. He was completely against slavery, and, you know, he was the first one in. He became a captain, eventually a colonel, and as mentioned, the Battle of Shiloh, he raised his arm for his men to charge, and his arm was shot with a lead ball, shattered. In those days, they, you know, it was 1869, they didn't have really any knowledge of how to treat people, and they sawed his arm off with a saw while he was awake. He survived it and let it heal a little bit and went back for more service, became a colonel. Now he had
his right arm?
His left arm. And maybe it was his right arm. Take that back. It is his right arm, I think. But he had this indomitable spirit about him right from the beginning. He was an introvert for sure, but he could be extremely persuasive, very strong will, and whenever he went on an expedition, he completed the expedition, as you'll see. This is the Grand Canyon from space, from the International Space Station. This would have been really valuable to us at the time. And just to get a little perspective, if you zoom in on it, it's something that you literally can see from space. It's large. It's about 277 miles, the Grand Canyon in its entirety. And you'll notice that the north side is more pronounced than the left or the bottom south side. And the reason for that is when that area uplifted, it also tilted a little bit down so that when it drains, the drainage from the north is into the canyon, the drainage from the south is generally away from the canyon. So it's created this sort of disparity. And the rapids. What they didn't know before they started was how many rapids there are. About 10% of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon is rapids. And there's over 100 of them. And many of them are class 4, class 5 rapids. Class 6 is when you go over a waterfall. Which fortunately there aren't any. So this, to give you a perspective, and let's take this out. So it can give you a little 360 here of the canyon. You can see that it's pretty rugged territory. Sorry, I'm doing this just by that's the sky. Just shift. Let's try it again. So this is the same Colorado that, you know, John Wesley would have been going through. And it's not all, you know, really intense and, you know, difficult. A lot of it is sort of like easy. And you could probably go through it on a bathtub. If we look at it from above, you get sort of a helicopter view of it. But the terrain, you know, it's still to this day, you know, pretty rough all around that area. So once they started down the river, the idea of climbing up the canyon and walking out to civilization someplace was really not an option.
Is there a dam at that point?
Nope.
Is the river always muddy like that?
Yes.
You know, it used to be muddy all the time. In fact, it was like too thick to drink, but too thin to plow was sort of the same. However, they have dammed the river in many places, and then what happens is the sediment, you know, settles to the bottom, and the river, large parts of the river had turned green. It used to be 68 degrees, now it's like 40-something degrees. Whoa. So the dams were made just almost spontaneously, but the ecological impacts are tremendous. Ironically, one of the most beautiful places he found was Glen Canyon, which was dammed and filled, and they named it Lake Powell, which Powell would never have wanted anything like that. Now, because the rapids play such a big part in what we're doing tonight, let's have a little taste of the rapids and what it's like. This is a pontoon boat, and this generally is what people, you know, use in the river. But even with that, it's very, very difficult. So, you know, the rivers are classified, whether it be class 5, class 4, and the Colorado is considered to be, you know, one of the roughest rivers in the world, and certainly in the country. Many of them are listed on the right, and they have, you know, back-to-back sort of rapids. There's one place, Lava Canyon Rapids, it descends 37 feet in just a couple thousand yards. And then they're back to back. And we'll take you through that in a little bit. Another example, these are experienced rafters in modern equipment. And it doesn't look all that easy to me. There was sound, but I couldn't really share the expletives. So, you know, views of the canyon are spectacular. It's transformative, and many people view it as almost like taking a pilgrimage when you go to the Grand Canyon. And the American Indians did take pilgrimages to it, and they viewed it as a center of great force. And that the reason that the river was so rough was to keep people from going into the center of force. It has moods. During the summer, it can rain really, really hard there. You know, there are twists and turns. There's really nothing quite like it on Earth that I've ever seen.
Is that a boat down there?
That is a boat. That's a lot of it has been dammed and turned into recreation areas. So you got your motorboats, your helicopters. I think you get it. But spectacular and even intimate in so many ways. That's Redwall Cavern, which was discovered and named by John Wesley Powell. In fact, he named the Grand Canyon. And as they went through, they named everything. So, you know, Desolation Creek, Whirlwind Bend, all kinds of different names that they just make up as they went along. He does write in his diary, a beautiful diaries that he wrote, that 50,000 people could fit into Redwall Canyon, although the number has been reduced down to about 2,000. So maybe they were really small people then. I don't know.
Did they map? Were they photographers?
They were mapping as they went, absolutely. All right, well, President Roosevelt, the Grand Canyon fills me with awe. It's beyond comparison, beyond description, unparalleled throughout the wide world. And, you know, he was a great hero for the environment, for conservation, for ecology. And he established 5 national parks, 8 national monuments, bird refuges, you know, national forests. Because as the settlers came west, they decimated everything and everybody. You know, this clear-cut forest, or you know, during the gold rush, you know, they used, you know, large hoses to sort of just dig up the land, looking for gold. And you know, as you drive up through the foothills today, the remnants of that digging is still evident out there. And Roosevelt really felt like that was just really not the way to go, and that by establishing refuges, not only would it help people to gain a kind of repose, but would help teach us how to treat the land, how to treat the rivers. And he felt that it was completely wrong to kill a mammal or to cut down a tree or to pollute a river, that this is just something human beings shouldn't do. So, you know, definitely hats off to Teddy Roosevelt. By the way, the teddy bear is named after him. He used to hunt bear. And they came across a couple of cubs, but they didn't have the heart to kill it. So they brought him home. And as they were getting out of their vehicle carrying these bears, people were taking photographs, and then they replicated them as stuffed animals. And that's where teddy bears came from. Now, right around this time, fortunately, we started to get photographs. So I'm going to feature a whole bunch of photographs tonight by John K. Hillers. He was the photographer on the second mission. There were 2 expeditions down the river, but there is a lot of overlap. And they would take photographs with double-lensed cameras, and then you look at them through a viewer to give a 3D effect. But these are the Utes, and they speak volumes just by their expression and clothing and attitudes. Now, the Indians, you know, had this tremendous reverence for the land, something we can all learn from, and they actually spent most of their time outdoors and really came in touch with the sounds of the land, the murmurs of the earth, the animals, the rocks, and to them, everything was part of this great dance. That's just one way to put it. When Westerners, when Europeans started to invade the area, they were simply awestruck by it. And the very first surveyors that came in were so overtaken by so many of the features that they actually named many of the peaks, which they called temples, after the great traditions on Earth, because they felt that this, the Grand Canyon, one of the 7 wonders of the world, deserved to have the highest designation of human culture. So they named things like the Vishnu Temple, the Shiva Temple, Isis Temple, Brahma and Zoroaster Temples, Wotan's Throne, the Buddha Temple, so that these things kind of evoke, you know, something higher in human nature. And pretty much, no matter how many times you see it, still works. The very bottom of the Grand Canyon, where the river runs through the Vishnu Schist, is 2 billion years old. And, you know, the Earth is 4.3, we think, billion years old. So the river carved the canyon over the period of something like 5 to 7 million years, and it revealed these geological columns by which we can read the history of the Earth. And we'll do some of that in a moment. So the levels of the canyon are depicted here, and each level has a different meaning. Now, remember, or probably too young to remember, but many millions of years ago, the ocean was lapping up against a shore that is roughly where Denver is now. And everything else was ocean on the west coast. And the ocean would recede and come in. We're talking about geological time here. Anyway, over the course of many, many, many years, different layers actually settled to form the Grand Canyon. And some of them are like sort of limestone layers. And these limestone layers are ancient ocean beds. So as you say, you walk down the Bright Angel Trail, named by John Wesley Powell, you'll see actual marine fossils right there. So you'll be like 6,000 feet above the river, and there are marine fossils from ancient oceans. And so, you know, these different layers are available. So if you want to remember the layers, know the canyon's history, study rocks made by time. You'll notice K corresponds to the Kaibab Formation, T to Toro Weep, C to Coconino, and so forth. So it's an easy way to remember the various layers of the Grand Canyon. A couple of them, like number six, don't necessarily fit in because you can't see it. But that's an easy way to remember it. And these are the various ages of the Grand Canyon. So when you get down to the very bottom, you know, 2.5 billion, we're talking about billions, we have some flex room. And all of these layers have life forms in them. So you're looking at this tremendous geological history. Dinosaurs were like, what, 65,000 years ago? Well, that's the top level. You know, so this is just getting perspective on these things. So when you think about time, we don't normally think about time in these like huge epochs. It really sort of melts something in you, you know, like, oh, I'm 3 minutes late to work or something. It's like, well, just think of the Grand Canyon. Tell your boss that. I'm sure he'll appreciate it. all right, so what we're seeing is this tremendous erosion that takes place. And how could this erosion actually occur? I mean, you know, could a river actually do this? And the answer is, yeah, it can. The river actually started to carve through this area. And then as the carving proceeded and it started to create caverns, monsoons would come in and flow down into the river and cause rocks and everything to tumble, just like giant pieces of sandpaper actually ground down the sides of the canyon. And the side on to your right is the north, and it's tilted down, so it slides more easily into the canyon, whereas on the left-hand side, the water sweeps away from it. It was caused by a couple of things. And this is a picture of when there's monsoon. It's not like it rains gently. Big, dark waterfalls appear on the canyons filled with rocks, and it's just this grinding sound. But it starts with deposition, so there are, you know, sedimentary rocks that actually settle over very, very, very long periods of time. And then these, over a very long period of time, like going back maybe 40 to 50 million years ago, there was an uplifting of the Colorado Plateau. Remember, the Sierras weren't even created until 4.5 million years ago. And when the Colorado started to run, the path of least resistance came out in Monterey. Then when the Sierras started to uplift, the river turned, and there was a sort of a fault down in the Sea of Cortez that causes the depression, and the river now flows down into that direction. So a river can change its course, and there's an example of it. The downcutting is the river just constantly grinds right through rock, and then the canyon walls just sort of collapse down into it. This is solid rock, so when we start to think about this, it's remarkable that, I mean, if you went out there with an axe or, you know, some kind of a chisel and tried to break the rock, you could spend weeks and, like, hardly make a dent in it. But these forces of erosion constantly grinding cause it to happen. Actually, you could look at it like this. If each brook is like a layer, and these layers build up over millions and billions of years. Some of them are thicker than others, some of them are not. And it would look something like that. And then there's sort of a general uplift. But what happens as the canyon starts to form is that these layers are like revealed like this. So originally they were like that, and then they're revealed by the erosion in the canyon, causing these various layers to be revealed to us. Here's an example of when there's monsoon there, what it looks like. I'm not sure exactly where that's at, but that happens all over the canyon. It's a big grinding process, and it occurs pretty frequently. And then in the winter, things freeze, and when water, you know, freezes, it expands, and that causes it to crack away and so forth. So it's been under development for somewhere between 5 and 7 million years. There is a bigger canyon on Mars. It's about the size of the United States. It's almost 3,000 miles across. Our canyon goes down about a mile. That canyon goes down 10. Our canyon is like, it's between 4 miles across, 18 miles across. This one is measured in hundreds of miles. I mean, just to show you how far we've come, 1869, they didn't have a map of the Grand Canyon. Now we have the Mars surveyors doing detailed maps of Martian canyons, you know, down to a square meter. Unbelievable. All right, well, the exploration started with the Spanish in 1540. Coronado and his group came up looking for the seven cities of gold, or so we're told. They had horses. The American Indians had never seen horses before. So no matter what movie you're watching, if they had horses, it was after the Spanish. And the Spanish roamed around. They met up with the Hopi Indians, who became their guides. And it's widely circulated that the Hopis led them where they wanted them to go. Not where the Spanish wanted to go. And they found the going to be really tough. They tried to climb down into the canyon. They just couldn't do it. It was too hard. There wasn't water. There was no trails. So they decided, they kind of looked down and decided, well, there's probably not gold there. Let's skip it. And they kind of wandered around. But this was in 1540 that they were there. The American Indians, of course, have been there for thousands and thousands of years. So in 1869, there were about a billion people on Earth. There were about 31 million people in the United States, which was more than I thought. There were about 500,000 American Indians. This picture was actually taken by Ansel Adams, the great Ansel Adams. But the Indians and, you know, gained horses. This changed everything for them. You know, a much wider area could be covered. They could hunt better. Everything started to accelerate for them once that they had these horses. But even in 1860, this was taken in probably 1870, you still had scenes like this in America. Of course, the American Indians did not have language that was written. They had verbal language, but they had pictographs and petroglyphs. And you'll notice up in the upper left that there's a person on a horse. So, and one on the right, and when was carbon dated? This goes back to the 1600s. So not pre-Spanish, but post-Spanish. This is John Hillers, who a photographer who took a lot of historical photographs you're going to see tonight. Photography in those days was hard. First, you had a great big box that you had to carry around. Each photograph was on a glass plate. You want to take 10 photographs? Take 10 glass plates. And then haul them around with you everywhere. Exposures had to be several minutes. Very, very complex. And anyway, he came up with some wonderful stuff that we'll see tonight. Like this picture of an American Indian. Each had their names are interesting. This person's name was Runs at Night. That was his name. And I just love his expression. You know, it's sort of like kind of at peace with things. This would be the camera that they would use around this time. Cameras started to come into their own. Previously, 1832, you know, we had daguerreotypes from France. But it had two lenses, and the idea was to take duplicate pictures, put them on a card, bend the card, and look through them cross-eyed through a viewer to get a 3D effect. and so when you see this kind of configuration, that's what they were doing. Just for practical purposes, most of the photographs we'll see tonight, I've taken just one frame so that you can see it that way. Here's a Ute Indian with an eagle. Looks like a golden eagle that he used for hunting. This is a game that the children were playing called Wolf and Bear. It really looks like fun. Walking down the road, they would encounter scenes like this. Just people living their lives around the Grand Canyon. A lookout, just a regular in front of your home sort of scene. These are Hopi Indian girls with whorls. They have their hair and whorls on the sides of their head. A lot of people say Princess Leia took her idea for Star Wars from them. A Navajo shaman, and this is a Zuni dwelling. All of these are probably the first pictures that were taken in this area.
Did Apollo have the camera with him on his expedition through the...
Hillers went with him on the second expedition. 1871.
Gee whiz, the camera made it through the rapids and everything?
Yeah, well, the second time they went through, they were more well-prepared. After the Spanish, the next people to arrive were the mountain men of the 1800s. These were real, truly rugged individuals, many of them inspired by Lewis and Clark. They'd wander out, they'd live in the mountains, they had firearms, and they were trappers. And they'd go out, it was very profitable to be a trapper. Beaver pelts were highly desired in Europe. And they'd catch as many as they could and bring them back and get a lot of money. But in the meantime, a lot of times they'd introduce themselves to tribes and it would go well, but often it would not. And many, if not most of them, ended up being shot with arrows and chased or even tortured. After they hunted out all the pelts, by 1840, they killed almost every beaver in these areas. They then became guides to people coming out of west. And that's eventually how they made their living. Then by the 1860s, they were actually building cabins. They took on American Indian wives, most of whom they bought. And then they would raise families and raise cattle because hunting was too hard for them. They just said, forget it, it's easier to raise cattle. So when Powell came out to explore the expedition, they all said, nobody we know has been down the canyon. Nobody we know would ever do it. They went to American Indians, and the American Indians said, same. We don't know anybody who's been down there and been through. It's too rough. It's too brutal. But Powell went anyway. And so we have a picture of his boat, one of his boats on the right. And as I mentioned, this boat was not made for a river. But this is the boat that they chose. He named one of his boats the Emma Dean after his wife. And you know, the credits of his life read like this. He was, of course, in the Civil War, he became a geologist, naturalist, and a linguist, explorer, anthropologist. Before the expedition, he was a professor at Wesleyan University. He actually taught geology and various languages. Ran two expeditions, then became the director of the U.S. Geological Survey, one of the first directors. Director of the Bureau of Ethnology, authored many books and articles on geology and cultures around the Grand Canyon, American Indian, linguistic and sociological researcher, and co-founder of the National Geographic Society, gave the first presentation there on the Grand Canyon and his expedition.
Another question.
Yeah.
Didn't Powell portage a number of the worst rapids?
He did. They did portage, meaning they come up to the rapids, they look too hard, they pull over to the side, they carry the gear down on the side, and then line down the boats, and then recollect them. The problem is hard work. They wore out their shoes. So for most of the expedition, the men didn't have shoes. Whoa. Very tough. Very tough. Transcontinental Railway finished May 10th, 1869, runs right by the Green River. What I find interesting about this photograph is that most of the people that worked on the railroad, 13,000 out of 15,000, were Chinese. However, they're not in the picture. So there you go.
You got to drink that bottle of champagne.
Do you mean when they were crossing, they hiked and they lowered the boats?
The boats were in the river and then they lower them down down the river with ropes,
yeah,
and then recollect them. But the gear that was in them, they had like 1,500 pounds of gear in each one,
yeah,
and they'd have to take those out and shoulder them down the river on the side, on the beaches.
They walked.
They walked.
And in case the boat capsized, they just carried the stuff?
Correct.
And so, they draw them like a rope, they pulled it?
Yep.
I guess the cliffs were not sheer in those places.
Not in those places, but even if they were a little tight, they could still walk in the shallower water. I can't stress enough what a bad idea it was to use these boats. Nobody on the crew had ever been down a river with rapids, nobody. And so when they planned it, this is an actual boat on the right and a picture on the left, made out of solid oak, they weighed 2,000 pounds, rode really low in the water. They had 1,500 pounds of gear in each one because they planned for 10-month voyage. They had, you know, bacon and coffee and stuff like that, you know, sausage, most of which got ruined within the first week. And the boats were so low in the water, at one point, Powell says, we had to chuck 500 pounds of bacon into the river.
Oh.
500 pounds of bacon. They were especially difficult to steer because they were end loaded. So the gear was in the front and the back of the boat. So if you think of the dynamics or the physics of that, you walk around with weights on the end of your hand and then they want you to turn real fast. You know, whereas if you had it towards the center, if it was center weighted, then you could spin very rapidly. And everybody who watches Sunday football knows that. So, Danson's here? Yeah. Now, in 1984, they rebuilt the boats to the specs of the originals, got highly trained river rafters to take them down through the rapids that Powell's boats went through, and I'm going to show you that momentarily. So the objects of the mission, to explore the great unknown, to map the territory, conduct scientific research of the area, although all they had was a barometer, a sextant, and a temperature gauge, so I'm not sure what kind of science they were going to do. Maybe observation, to assess the natural resources and feasibility of settlement. We'll go through these again after the mission. Powell, as I mentioned before, from his childhood experiences, really enjoyed the American Indians and became friends with them and knew many of their languages and consulted with them before he took the journey. The members of the crew were, six of them were from Civil War associations, had never done anything on a boat, and three of them were mountain men. Only one person in the crew had ever done anything with a boat, and he had never been through rapids. So that's a picture of the crew. They did have the gentleman, yes. It's great to go down a river in a suit, that's perfect. He did have a diary, and he was a very good writer. And I highly recommend the book of his writing, Going Down. It took a lot of care. He's got good sentence structure, sort of beautiful lyrics. One of his crew members also had a diary. They drew maps. They named things. They would often take side trips and expeditions. This is where they started, on the Green River. Looks really good, like every expedition you ever take. It's going to be easy, it's going to be fun, and it's sunny. So that's great. Now, one of the things that he was really interested and open to was the idea of the sound in the canyon. And it can't be stressed enough how important true sound and silence is, because we almost don't have any of it anymore. So he said, mountains of music swell in the river and hills of music billow in the creeks, while other melodies are heard in the gorges and the lateral canyons. The Grand Canyon is a land of song. So it's clearly alive at many levels. The time to go to hear sounds like that are sun up and late evening. That's when sort of nature really comes out and starts to resonate with things. Highly recommend Bernie Krause. He did a TED Talk and has been measuring soundscapes for many decades. What makes that valuable is that he'll measure a soundscape and come back 20 years later and compare the sound. And the results are pretty staggering. And he's been all over the world, Africa, all these different places. And so you can hear what he's recorded. Stunning. His point is that we've developed learned deafness, that we're learning to listen, but to the wrong things. We're listening to headphones, we're listening to city sounds, and that when we actually come in contact with natural sound, we just don't know how to hear it anymore. Note that the decibel level of a urban area is like 70 or 80 decibels, really loud. But when you come down into these natural places like the Grand Canyon on a remote trail, it's like almost completely quiet. It really does something to you. So these are some of the cliffs that were photographed. And at one point, Powell went up to do an observation with Bradley, one of the guys on the trip. And because he only had one hand, he reached a point where he couldn't pull himself up, but the ledge was too far below him. So Bradley quickly stripped off his long underwear and lowered it down to him. So what he had to do was let go with his one arm and then quickly grab the underwear. And he was 800 feet above the canyon, which was, you know, was successful, thankfully.
Is that a painting?
That is a painting, yeah. And he said, I never wanted to let my one arm prevent me from doing anything I want to do in life. Wow. And this would be an example of that. All right, let's go to the movie. And this is about 25 minutes. It's far from professional, but it features Clay Jenkinson, a historian. He's presenting to the Grand Canyon, and I took clips and audio. I also took clips from the replication of Powell's expedition in 1984, John Cahiller's photographs, a bunch of historical photographs.
My friends call me Wes, and my colleagues call me the Major, but the Ute and Paiute Indians, whose culture I studied for many, many years, called me Copperots, one arm gone. Copperots, arm missing. Such is the directness of the Indian mind. You know me, of course, for my great adventure down the Green and Colorado rivers in 1869. And so let me say this much. Most of the important work that I did was right here in Washington. I moved here in 1872 after my second Colorado journey, and I helped to establish the Cosmos Club in 1878. In fact, the first meeting of the what would become the Cosmos Club was in the parlor of my house, not so very far from here. And as you just heard, on January 13th, 1888, I was one of 33 men who gathered at the Cosmos Club to create the National Geographic Society. I don't know what I would have done if it hadn't been for the Civil War, but the minute it happened, I joined the volunteer infantry and served in a range of different places. But at the Battle of Shiloh on April 6th, 1862, I was leading a charge over a ridge, and an unspent or nearly spent mini ball, that's a lead ball with a conical top, struck me just below the elbow and shattered it. 2 days later, without anesthetic of any sort, They sawed off my arm just below the elbow. That hurt. It never stopped me from doing a single thing in the course of my life. Now, after the Civil War, the country was a different place, and there was a lot of disillusionment in the East. And there was a sort of a sense that maybe there was a new beginning out West. I had the idea that there was one region of this country that was still unexplored, and that was the canyons of the Green and Grand and Colorado River. And so I decided to put together a small exploring party and see if it could be done. And we met at Green River Station, and we embarked on our journey down the Green in Colorado on the 24th of May, 1869. There were 10 of us to start. None of them were scientists. I didn't really even have scientific credentials at the time. 4 boats. Enough provisions for about 10 months. And off we went into the unknown on May 24th, 1869. I can't tell you all of the stories of our adventure, but I can give you, a flavor of it. First, about the depths. You know, we started at a flat place, and then we would go down 1,000 feet into the earth, and then 3,000 feet, and eventually in the Grand Canyon, we were 6,000 feet into the bowels of the earth. In a lecture that I gave when I came back, I said it would be as if there were a street like Broadway in New York, and there were skyscrapers on either side of that street, and they were 200 stories high for 600 miles. That's what it felt like. It was glorious. You know, every time we came around a bend in the river, we were seeing something that nobody had ever seen before. We had no idea what to expect. That's the nature of exploration, isn't it? 2 weeks into the excursion, in the canyon of Lodore, we had disaster. I had developed a series of flag and hand signals in the pilot boat, and if I made a certain sort of signal, then the men were to get to shore, and we would reconnoiter and maybe portage or line down the boats or see if there was a way to thread our way through the rapids. But for some reason, 3 of the boats came into shore, but the no-name, the 4th of the boats, did not get to shore. There was a long dispute later about what had happened, and maybe that they didn't see the signal, maybe that they ignored it. They said that the boat was so waterlogged that they were bailing and didn't see anything. But whatever it was, that 4th unfortunate boat, the no name, went over the first rapid and recovered well enough, and then it struck a rock sideways and split in two. The men were thrown from it, and most likely would have drowned if they hadn't washed up on a little sandbar in the middle of the river. Frank Goodman, the Florida Englishman, found a rock and he was holding on to it for dear life. Well, we rescued them, but now the no name was gone. And with it, all of the personal effects of the 3 men in the boat, Ormel and Seneca Howland and Frank Goodman, their clothing, their personal kits, fully 1/3 of our provisions, including food, rifles, ammunition, and scientific instruments, were now lost. In fact, in searching through the other 3 boats, we discovered that for some unknown reason, we had packed all of the thermometers and barometers in the no name. Now, we had very little pretensions to real science, but all of them were now gone. With a barometer, you can determine the altitude above camp of the cliffs, and the thermometers would be useful. And that night, I despaired. I thought I might leave the expedition and go overland to Salt Lake and bring back more barometers and see if we could piece it back together. But it was a time of great gloom. A third of our provisions just 2 weeks into the expedition. The next morning, after a good sleep, we discovered that the No Name, at least part of the hull, had lodged against some rocks on the other side of the river. And so Jack Sumner and another man said that they would be willing to take the Emma Dean, the pilot boat, and see if they could go over there and determine if anything had been saved. And at some risk to themselves, they made their way across the rapids and to the wreckage. And you have to understand that when you're in the canyons, you can't hear a thing. It's like the sound of 10 freight trains going by at close proximity. And so it was a pantomime there. And they got to the hull of the No Name, and they searched around it for a while, and they held up a package, and it was the barometers. And so we were saved as a scientific expedition. And then they dug around some more, and then they were dancing in glee, and I had no idea that their commitment to science was what it was. But it turns out that they had secreted a keg of whiskey. I'm a teetotaler. I had forbidden whiskey on this tour. They had secreted a keg, and it was intact. So when they got back, I made an executive decision and decided to call that whiskey medicinal. Say is that the canyons are so deeply incised there that when you look up you see a kind of a quarry, but not a quarry where castles are made, a quarry where mountains could be lifted out from the rocks. And the cliffs are so high that it's not the kind of place where you would see swallows having their nests part way up. You'd see eagles, and those eagles would disappear from sight before they reached the summit. And it's one of the most amazing places on Earth, and it's a geologist's dream. You know, in England, geology is difficult because it's all covered with verdure.
Yes.
But here, the country is exposed because of the aridity, and Earth reveals its skeleton and its spine and its entablature. It's a geologist's paradise. Our provisions by now were rotten. The flour was sour. The bacon was molded. There was nothing good to eat. And shortly after the disaster with the no-name, we had been making dinner on a little spot of sand at the beach. And unfortunately, Hawkins had caught the trees on fire right there, and they burned down the camp. And we got singed eyebrows and clothes burned, and we scrambled into the boats and went downriver. And Hawkins gathered up the cooking kit as best he could, and when he got to the boat, he tripped and lost almost all of it in the river. And so now we have spoiled food that we're cooking on one or two miserable pans. And it's about that point that we realized that we were in a race for life here. You can't really get out of these canyons. We had planned to hunt. There was not much to hunt. The bighorn sheep are high up and very skittish. There are almost no fish in these rivers, and the fish that we pulled out were like eating sandpaper that were pincushions. And so we were beginning to wonder whether we would survive this expedition. And on we went. Well, finally, on August 6th, we came to the mouth of the Little Colorado River. And if you know that part of the world, that's really the beginning of the Grand Canyon. Four wooden boats, now reduced to three, all being battered so much that we're caulking them almost every day. The men are mostly naked, living in rags, our shoes are gone. The food is rancid and inadequate. We're exhausted mentally and physically. We were about to begin the most dangerous and challenging part of the journey. But we were spent. Now, if we'd gone out at that point and regrouped and put some flesh back on our bones and written some letters home and relaxed a little and come back, we might have been able to do this with some ecstasy. But by the time we reached the portal of the Grand Canyon, we were in a pretty desperate state, and the rumblings of discontentment were beginning to reach even me. Here's what I wrote. We are now ready to begin on our way down the great unknown. Our boats, tied to a common stake, chafe each other as they are tossed by the fretful river. They ride high and buoyant, for their loads are lighter than we could desire. We have but a month's rations remaining. We are now 3/4 of a mile in the depths of the earth, and the great river shrinks into insignificance as it tosses its angry waves at the walls and cliffs that rise to the world above. Its waves are but puny ripples, and we but pygmies running up and down the sand or lost among the boulders. We have an unknown canyon yet to explore, an unknown river to run. What falls there may be, we know not. What walls rise over the river, we know not. What rocks beset the channel, we know not. Ah, well, the men talk as cheerfully as ever this morning. Jests are bandied about freely among them. And yet to me, the jests are ghastly and the cheer is somber. Even I, the optimist, begin to call the Grand Canyon our prison. In terms of the magnificence of the scenery, there's nothing like it in the world. Its geological potential unmatched. But we were now just hoping to survive. Had we been told before we started that the Grand Canyon would contain the kinds of rapids that it has, we never would have tried it. Ever. Well, finally, on the 27th of August, things fell apart. We came to the worst rapid that any of us had ever seen. And it wasn't at all clear that we could survive it. And so that day, Orville Howland came to me and took me aside and said, "Major, we can't go on. It's suicide now to go on." He said, "What good would it be for us to die now at this late stage of the expedition and lose everything? What we should do is admit that we can't do it, not in our current condition and with these boats. And we'll climb the north face of the canyon, and we'll find our way to some Mormon villages. We'll regroup and maybe come back and do it another time. We can cache the boats. But if we go on, we're all going to die." Well, I said, "If we try to climb out, we're probably going to die. It's not even clear you can climb out a mile up the north face of the Grand Canyon." And here's what I wrote. "We have another little talk about tomorrow, and he lies down again. But for me, there is no sleep. All night long, I pace up and down a few yards of sand beach along by the river. Is it wise to go on? I go to the boats again to look at our rations. I feel certain we can get beyond the dangers immediately before us. But what may be below, I know not. From our position yesterday, high up on the cliffs, the river seemed to make another great bend to the south, which from our experience heretofore means more and higher granite walls. I'm not sure we can climb out of the canyon here, and when at the top of the wall, I know enough of the surrounding countryside to be certain that it is a desert of rock and sand between this and the nearest Mormon village, which on the most direct line must be at least 75 miles away. True, the late rains have been favorable to us should we climb out, for the chances are we shall find water standing in pools. And at one time, I almost decide to leave the river. But for years, I have been contemplating this trip. To say there is a part of the canyon I cannot explore, a part of the Colorado I cannot run, having already almost accomplished it, is more than I am willing to acknowledge, and I determined to go on. Now, we have no choice but to face this thing." And Bradley agreed to go first in one of the boats. We abandoned the Emma Dean now, so now we have two leaky boats left. And Bradley said he would go first to take a look. And so we lined him down with all the rope we still had in our possession. Got him as far out on that Herculean rapid as we could. And he was going to look to see what it looked like downriver. But the Colorado began to sway his boat back and forth like a pendulum. And it was riding from one cliff to the other, hitting the wall and then hitting the other wall. And it was certain that he would be smashed to smithereens. And so he took out his knife, and he cut the rope. Over the falls he went. We were certain he was dead. And a minute or two later, his boat popped up, and he was alive, and he waved his hat like a rodeo cowboy. And now we did the stupidest thing we ever did. The rest of us got in the other boat without anything and just did it. We just popped over the thing. It was insane. And we were half drowned and waterlogged and was scrambled to shore. And there was one more significant rapid, and then we were out. Then we were at Grand Wash Cliffs. And from 6,000 feet, the cliffs diminished to nothing. And I wrote one of the last entries in my diary. I said, ever before us has been an unknown danger heavier than the immediate peril. Every waking hour we have spent in the Grand Canyon has been one of toil. We have watched with deep solicitude the steady disappearance of our scant supply of rations, and from time to time have watched as the river snatched away a little that was left to us while we were hungered. And toil and danger have been known in those great depths, where oft times clouds hid the sky by day, and but a narrow zone of stars could be seen at night. Only during the few hours of deep sleep consequent on hard labor has the roar of the waters been hushed. But now the danger is over, now the toil has ceased, now the gloom has disappeared, and now the firmament is bounded only by the far horizon. And what a vast expanse of stars can now be seen.
I'm not sure how many of us could take 99 days of that. Really, truly looked like a difficult mission. And on my return from the first expedition of the canyons, I found that our journey had been the theme of much newspaper writing. A story of disaster had been circulated with many particulars of hardship and tragedy, so that it was currently believed throughout the U.S. that the members of the party were lost, save one. And a good friend of mine had gathered a great number of obituary notices. And it was interesting and rather flattering to me to discover the high esteem with which I had been held by the people of the United States. In my supposed death, I had attained to a glory which I fear my continued life has not fully mitigated. So what was gained from all this? He'd explored it, he mapped it, some scientific research was gathered, something about natural resources, but what really came out of it was that it fueled him, and he became the head of the U.S. Geological Survey. And he says his take on the whole area and the river was that we have to very carefully plan it. It should be done in communities, and communities should be located sort of abutting a stream or some kind of a creek or something, that you can't just send everybody out there to settle anywhere that they want. That will overturn the natural balance of nature. Horace Greeley said, well, the rain follows the plow. If we go, the rain will come. And in a sense, it did come, because they started building all these dams. And the dams, of course, are filling up with sediment. And this poses a whole new problem for us. This was the map that he proposed for the Western United States. It's based on watershed. Now, let's take just a second and look at this. All the water on Earth could fit in that bubble that you see right there.
The big one?
The big bubble. It would cover the United States to a depth of 107 miles. That's all the water on Earth. The medium bubble is all the fresh water on Earth. But about 98% of it is locked up in the ice caps and in groundwater. So the very, very, very small bubble that you see down near Georgia is water that's in streams and rivers that human beings can use. That's all the water. And that was fine when there was a billion people on Earth in 1869, but there are 7.5 going on 8 billion now, but the water hasn't increased. So fresh water in the ice caps and glaciers, groundwater. If you analyze all the water sources, the usable fresh water is a very small percentage. So the gold kind of spike is what we have available to us. How much water do you use? Well, if you look at your water bill, it's probably, you know, maybe you use 50 or 100 gallons a month, something like, or a day. But you're not counting the other sources. So a hamburger is the equivalent of spending 634 gallons of water, because you have to raise the beef and the wheat and so forth. A pound of beef is almost 2,000 gallons of water. As you come down the food chain a little bit towards, you know, natural fruits and vegetables, it's 1/20th of that. Clothing, like jeans, take almost 3,000 gallons of water, because when you have that stone wash jean, that's they do that with water. So if you're a carnivore, or you're going to on average consume 2,508 gallons per day. And if you're not a carnivore, about half of that. So it's just something to consider when we consider our water footprint. And if you could, if you just Google National Geographic water footprint, you'll get a table and you can calculate your own water use. So I think I'll leave it at that and just say hopefully Powell's determination is something we can carry forward. And even though we're not literally going through rapids, we're going through rapids in other ways. But his courage, his determination, his foresight, his idealism carried him, and it'll carry us too. Thank you very much. So, Carolyn, you're going to tell us where to go?
Yeah, that certainly gives us a lot to think about, and about ourselves, about our country, about our particular location, our drought, but also our character. So.